Raphael, I received your letter requesting information regarding some personal experiences in the Battle of the Bulge in the area of around St. Vith. From what you have told me and from what Bruce Harrison advised me, you are intending to write a book in English at some point and describe the Battle of the Bulge from a different perspective. As you're well aware, the Battle of the Bulge took place from the 17th to the 23rd of December in 1944. And I might suggest that because of the total confusion that reigned during this period, that my memory may not be quite as sharp as it was some 45 years ago, or 46 years ago, I guess. Let me say, in starting out, that I'm sure you're going to research the bulge in great depth, and I sort of think that with the confusion that exists and the variances in stories that you'll hear, it might be well to see if you can secure from the U.S. Army Armored School at Fort Knox, Kentucky, a pamphlet called The Battle at St. Vith, Belgium, December 17th, 23rd, 1944, subtitled An Historical Example of Armor and Defense. I might also suggest, and I'm not at all sure this is possible, although I don't see any reason to believe that it would be classified at this point in time, but to secure the distinguished unit citation for any unit, a very detailed after-action report has to be submitted to the Adjutant General for review, and they're quite detailed. Our unit did receive the distinguished unit citation, and the recommendation for it is quite detailed and might even be at some variance with the facts and also the statistics in the battle at St. Vith, Belgium, which I referred you to before. In any case, if you can get your hands on a copy of that, and I would suggest that you might have to write to the Armor School in Fort Knox, Kentucky for the first piece of literature and to the War Department of the U.S. Army in Washington, D.C., Office of the Adjutant General, and see what sort of cooperation you might get. In any case, as I indicated before, there was substantial confusion that reigned during this period. We, meaning our unit, the 17th Tank Battalion, of which I then was the executive officer, were up in northern Germany around Keilenkirchen in what was supposed to be a area that we were assigned to for repair of vehicles and necessary maintenance that would be required for a continuing offensive that was to be directed against the area around Lindern and Linnick in northern Germany. On the evening of December the 16th, we were called to a meeting at headquarters and were very sketchily informed that our unit was to make a move to the south, to the area around St. Vith in Belgium. But at that time, there wasn't much in the way of other information except that we were to get the unit ready. You can well imagine that once a unit is pulled out of combat and put into what is supposedly a area to rehabilitate the vehicles and get some much-needed rest, the troops pretty much settle in and make themselves comfortable, and so a rapid order to move quickly is somewhat disconcerting, to say the least. In any case, we were able to get on the road with a very simple map, moving southbound in what was to be later come to our attention that we were the eastern column moving south into the vicinity of St. Vith, and that we would receive additional information as time went on. Well, as you will see by referring to some of the documents that have since come into being, there were two columns, one on the west side of the southbound movement, and as I said before, we on the eastbound side of the movement. We were the lead column, and had, as I indicated before, a very simple map showing that we were to go into the area somewhere around St. Vith, then we would be given instructions en route. And at that point, that was about the size of the information. We took off with myself being in the front of the column, with our commanding officer rotating between the front of the column and going back to check it. The move south was fairly uneventful, and we went through the town of Malmedy, an interesting town to keep in mind, as you might remember from your history, that it was the area that the massacre of the field artillery unit subsequently took place. When we went through the village of Malmedy, I remember vividly there being a unit hospital of some type, and the nurses and doctors and staff of the hospital being out on the street and waving to the column as we passed by. We then decided between the CO of the unit and myself that we would go into a bivouac area north of St. Vith, and the lack of information set up what we call an administrative bivouac, or an area that really wasn't necessary to protect heavily. This, of course, all contingent upon the fact that we had little or no information. As I went through Malmedy and several miles to the south, I was challenged by some American soldiers who had taken some landmines, tied them together with a rope, and had them across the road that we were heading southbound on. Upon stopping under their challenge, they wanted to see identification, and of course this was somewhat unusual, and I asked why they wanted identification, and they informed me that there was German paratroopers that had been dropped behind the American lines and were dressed in American uniforms. They then proceeded to ask some questions that only Americans would know, such as the name of the baseball team that played in New York, and the name of the manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, and his wife's name, and I thought to myself, it's a good thing that I was a baseball fan, or I wouldn't have known that Leo DeRocher was married to Lorraine Day at the time. In any case, they were satisfied that we were Americans, and they allowed us to proceed after removing the landmines from the roadway. I also told the troops on duty that were challenging our vehicle, that I was being followed by an armored division, and to make damn sure that the landmines were in place back across the road. As we got closer to St. Vith, in the area of Ober-Nemels and Nieder-Emels, we straddled a road that ran somewhat east and west toward the little village of Recht, R-E-C-H-T, and got there in late afternoon. This is late afternoon of the 17th of December, and I made sure that the communication half-track of the headquarters unit was pulled up next to a house occupied by civilians, and we stretched a line from the half-track inside the house so that we could listen to the communications inside the house rather than the need to be outside in the vehicle, because the weather was quite nasty, cold and foggy and dismal. In fact, the weather had been very rainy, and the roads were a sea of mud, and apparently the Western Column that I referred to before encountered worse road conditions than we did on the East Column. As I stated before, we went into what was an administrative bivouac, and as such, we put the service company, which was comprised of many trucks, and delivered gasoline and provisions, and were lightly armed at best, to the rear, with the combat elements facing to the east, which was the logical direction from which any attack might come. Little did we know the situation would somewhat change in a relatively short period of time. The most noticeable thing at that time was that there were occasionally troops moving to the west, and while their stories were very disjointed, we could gather that there had been a major attack coming from the east, with the target or the mission being to take the town of St. Vith. These troops, we learned, had become disorganized and had left their unit either by intent or by happenstance, and the confusion was rampant. Finally, a young officer came along this road, moving to the west, and I collared him and asked what in hell was going on. And he said, "Oh, there's Germans all over the place." And I said, "Well, what direction?" Well, he would point in several directions as we talked. And I said, "Well, I've been here for several hours and we haven't seen any Germans yet. And in fact, I haven't heard any sound of gunfire." Over the next short period of time, and as the afternoon wore on, we had one report from a straggler that there were German troops occupying the city of Malmedy. And I said, "This doesn't sound possible, because it wasn't so many hours before that we had moved through at Malmedy and with no enemy action whatsoever visible." However, there was so much confusion that rather than take a chance, I sent for the recon sergeant and instructed him to go north toward Malmedy, be very careful not to enter the town, and report if anything seemed to be unusual in the town, but to be damn careful, and if he heard any gunfire, to get back immediately and advise us. With that, Sergeant Sales, the reconnaissance sergeant, took off, heading north, along the road that ran from St. Vith to Malmedy. Within about what seemed 45 minutes later, Sergeant Sales came back and reported that there was gunfire definitely coming from the town, and that following my instructions, he did not enter it, but it was obviously enemy gunfire because of the distinctive sound of their weapons. At this point, Colonel Wemple, the battalion commander, had arrived on the scene, and after hearing this report, decided that the administrative bivouac was probably a mistake and that we should go into a defensive position, which we did. Again, looking to the east and to the north as the direction of the attack, if it were to come at all. We moved the units around, and I can remember having C Company paralleling the north-south road from St. Vith to Malmedy. I can remember also leaving the service company back to the rear of our, or to the west of our unit, thinking that this was the safest place for them to be. We found out later on this was not quite the case. And generally speaking, we got into a defensive position, hoping that the situation would clarify itself in time to come. The house that we used as a headquarters had a hayloft, and the men sort of converted this into a place where they were going to spend the night and sleep, and we went around our business getting things ready for the night. Within a short period of time, it was dark and still relatively quiet. In the meantime, we had taken one of our companies and put them astride the road that ran from the north-south Malmedy St. Vith Road to a road that ran generally north and west into the village of Recht. This was a light tank company and very mobile and not quite as cumbersome to move as the medium tank companies. In the dark of the evening, and at some point in the early hours of the morning, a substantial amount of enemy gunfire opened up, and it was to our west in the direction of Recht. A couple of the men that were sleeping up in the hayloft came down and said that there was gunfire coming into the hayloft, and that it was coming from the direction of the wrecked area. We realized at this point in time that the enemy somehow or other had gotten into the rear of our area, and we're making an attack from the west to the east, contrary to what we had first thought would have been the logical thing to have happen. It was pitch black, couldn't see a thing, and I can remember hearing the sound of a tank coming up the road from the direction of Recht, and I seriously thought that it was a German tank. And I immediately looked for the bazooka that we kept in the half track, and then remembered after I found it that I wasn't so damn sure I knew how to fire it, only having fired it one time and a long time back. Anyway, we finally got the damn thing put together, put a bazooka shell in place and attached, hooked it up, and I decided that I would go out on the edge of the road and wait for this vehicle to get closer before I would open fire on it. You don't know what goes through your mind at times like this, but as the tank sound of the tracks got closer and closer, almost to the point of being next to where I was, I shouted, "Halt!" And I was answered by one of our illustrious lieutenants who recognized my voice and responded to me by calling me by name. I wasn't too happy with the fact that he damn near got himself blown up together with the tank, and wondered and asked him why he was back there. Well, it was obvious that panic had set in, and the action had gotten pretty heavy. I think he was a fairly new lieutenant, and got confused and maybe lost a little courage. And in any case, I gave him the benefit of the doubt that when he said that he was coming back trying to reach somebody to give him instructions. Well, of course, it was easy to give him instructions, get back in line and mount and fend off any attack coming up that road from wrecked. The action became quite heavy during the dark hours, and in fact, the service company, which we had thought was in a protected position, had several vehicles that were hit by enemy fire, and of course, carrying ammunition and gasoline, they went up with a roar and lit up the area pretty well. The just east of wreck, there was a railroad track that was raised and an underpass that led directly from wreck to the area that we were in. It was fairly simple to guard against any vehicle attack by simply keeping the underpass covered, and those underpasses and the road net in those country areas was fairly narrow. One tank tried to get through it, one enemy tank tried to get through it. We took it under fire, hit it, obviously disabled it, but didn't knock it out, and it backed out. And to the best of my knowledge, they didn't try to get through that underpass with armored vehicles from that point on. The infantry attack, however, was somewhat different, and it was quite heavy, and with a lot of gunfire, and in the darkness, not being able to see whether or not you were hitting the enemy or just firing it in the general direction of the enemy. At some point in time, as usual, the firing dies down, and it became quite quiet, and there was no action for the rest of the dark hours. In the early morning, we were able to see that our fire against the enemy had taken some toll, and there were quite a few bodies lying out in front of our defensive positions. We had someone go out and try to identify their units, but they were beaten off with small arms fire coming from the direction of wreck. So we waited till the evening, and then they had a pretty good idea where the bodies were. We were able to go out and recover some of the identifications from the bodies and found out that we were fighting some top-notch troops from the Germans, the 1st SS Panzer Division, and et cetera, which was indicative of the fact that they were using top-notch troops so that whatever was happening was not happening as a diversionary measure, but rather a serious attempt to accomplish some serious mission. We subsequently learned that the Malmedy that I referred to before was the scene of what was later to become known as the Malmedy Massacre, where the artillerymen from the 285th Field Artillery Observation Battalion were mowed down by machine gun fire as they stood helpless with their hands over their heads. The chief of staff of the 7th Armored Division was killed about the same time and place. Colonel Matthews was his name, and Colonel Ryan, who had been commanding the reserve command that we were assigned to was appointed chief of staff. But that was of little consolation to us because, as we were later to determine, we were completely out of touch with any unit above us. We could not make contact by radio with either our combat command headquarters or the division headquarters. And we were in this position for about 3 days. It dawned on us the following day in daylight that the headquarters at the location that we were situated in was not the best place in the world to be. And we moved the headquarters or the command post into a wooded area in the same general area, but not on the road. At least it gave us a little more cover and a little bit more protection in the event that the attack would take place up that road. We could hear Germans across the north-south road on the east side. We could hear the movement of vehicles. Because we had no contact with battalion, or rather with combat command headquarters, we were unable to call for artillery support, and in fact had no forward observer in any case. That evening, the Germans made several attacks across the road against our position, and in the same spot every time. And I think it was our C company that was in place, and our tankers and our personnel in C company just simply repulsed the attack by tank fire and small arms fire, and the Germans would be disorganized, fall back. We could hear the confusion and the whistles blowing, and then a couple of hours later they would make another attack, and they would hit the same location the second time. And this went on two or three times in the course of the evening. If they had moved north or south of that point where C Company was located, they had clear sailing and there was absolutely nothing defending that our area, north and south, because we were spread out too far. But the Germans are creatures of habit, and apparently that's they thought that was the thing for them to do. And thankfully, we were able to repulse the attack. It dawned on us that we knew the Germans were in the east, opposite us on the astride of that north-south road, and we knew the attack had come the night before from the vicinity of St. Vith, and during the day we found that the Germans were traveling southbound through the village of Recht and to point south. An interesting thing developed that day, and one of our tankers in the light tank company, which was the nearest unit to the village of Recht, noticed a substantial amount of ambulances moving through Recht and southbound and back and forth. And it just seemed that there wasn't that much action to justify all that movement of ambulances. So at some point in time, he decided to fire on one of the ambulances, which he did, was able to make a direct hit, and lo and behold, the ambulance blew up, having been loaded down not with the injured personnel, but with ammunition. I don't know quite what the thinking of the Germans were at that time, thinking of the need to transport ammunition in ambulances, unless they didn't want to spare vehicles that they were using for some other purpose. In any case, it eliminated the heavy flow of ambulance traffic between the Malmedy and Recht area, moving southbound out of Recht. We recognized at that point that our position was quite critical. We had no communication, realized that we were cut off, and we're in a position where it was heavily wooded, and the confusion that we experienced with people straggling back from the rear, reports of field artillery pieces being abandoned, and tires being slashed, and gasoline being poured over them, and then the men just abandoning the artillery pieces did nothing to ease one's mind in terms of the future and what it held for us. The afternoon of that day was just a crazy situation at best. We were receiving some fire, but intermittently. I would spend most of my time in the half track, one, because it was warm, two, I wanted to be there if we were able to contact any unit at all, and we were attacked with the mortar fire at one point. It burst in a tree above the half track, and the radio operator that was in the half track with me, manning the radio, said that he was hit. And I suggested to him that he wasn't hit, but that the concussion of the shell bursting so close to the track felt like someone had hit you with a baseball bat. And he sort of slumped over at this point, and I went over, looked at him. I couldn't see any blood flowing. And finally, we got him out of the track, and you can remember that half tracks, when they have the canvas on top, which we had in this case, give it sort of a blackout situation. We had difficulty dragging him out, and we had an aid station established a short distance down one of the trails. And lo and behold, he had been hit with a piece of shrapnel from that mortar burst, and it had penetrated between his collarbone and punctured his lung. And of course, we weren't able to evacuate anybody, and we weren't equipped to take care of him very well in the aid station. So the young man, and I remember his name very well, George Gould, he died because of that episode. We were still out of contact with anybody, and we kept continually trying to make contact. And our CO came and indicated that he thought that our situation was such that we should take all the documents that were classified and the encoding device and destroy them and possibly get ready to have to surrender the unit to the enemy when the time developed. I disagreed and felt that at this point, while it was a scary situation, if we had all the classified documents and the encoding device in a place where we could destroy them immediately, that was adequate, and we didn't have to take any other action at this point. He agreed, and I guess it was sometime later on when we finally started to get some messages in from headquarters. Unfortunately, I guess we're in the third day now, which would bring us to the 19th of December. And the messages, we started to realize as they were coming in, they came in chronological order of date and time. So we were getting orders dated the 17th at 9 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning, and so forth during the course of the day. Some of these orders, of course, were contradictory at this point and no longer valid. And finally, at some point in the early evening, we got a current message sent the same day and within the same time frame of, let's say, 15 minutes. The summary of it was that Well, the previous messages had told us to move out and to move to this location and to that location. The last message that we had was that we were to stay in place and defend our position and be prepared to move upon receiving orders at some point in the future. And we also were told at this point that there was a forward observer from the field artillery battalion being sent forward to us and a company of infantry. I don't remember seeing the company of infantry, but the forward observer did finally show up, and we positioned him up around the area with the C Company along stride the north-south road. And every time we would hear what sounded like troop movement or noise, which was very, very audible, he would call on a fire mission, and we just wreaked havoc on the Germans by virtue of his being with us and being able to contact the artillery unit that he represented on a direct basis with his radio. So it took a lot of the pressure off. Each time that the noise would rise in intensity of preparation for what appeared to be a forthcoming attack, he would call on the artillery unit for fire support, and we would hear the confusion and chaos that reigned when the artillery barrage landed among the assembling German troops. About this point in time, we were assigned to Combat Command B, which was commanded by General Bruce Clark, who, as you know, rose to very lofty ranks, and I think at one point became in charge of all NATO forces in Europe. An excellent man, reserved, confident, stable, and it was sort of nice to belong to a combat command that was headed up by a very, very competent and able general. We were ordered to move out as best we could, and must remember that there was nobody around us, so that when we told them how critical the situation was, and that we had enemy on the east of us, and to the south of us, and to the west of us, and to the north of us, that that situation should be kept in mind with any further orders that might be forthcoming. General Clark ordered us to get out if we could, and to move in the vicinity of Rott, R-O-D-T. And also they detached, as I remember, one company of ours, and assigned it to somebody else, and I don't remember who, to protect the north flank and to stay in contact with the Combat Command A, which was on our north flank. As we were moving to Rott, we received a subsequent order that we were to go down and help Task Force Jones, who was fighting to our south. As we were leaving that area, and we were able to move out of that area because some of the streams were frozen solid, and we were able to take the tracked vehicles and the wheeled vehicles, in fact, and cross these frozen streams. If it hadn't been so cold and the ground frozen so solidly, we would not have been able to do that. I recall one instance where we captured a German half-track that looked as confused as we were and was wandering around and practically ran into our column. And they had about four occupants in the vehicle, and they were scared to death. And we took them out of the vehicle, and a nice way of treating a prisoner that It was to put them on the hood of our half track, which constantly had the motor running in order to keep the battery charged to use, so we could use the radios. And we'd stick them on the hood of the half track, and which got pretty damn hot. And if you didn't let them sit on their raincoat or on their overcoat, and just let the heat penetrate the pants, they'd squirm and try to get off. So that if they had any information, and you were fortunate enough to have someone that could speak German, which we did, they generally within a short period of time were willing to talk. In this instance, they knew less about what was going on than we did, and were barely able to give us anything more than their own units and where they thought they should have been, but weren't. At this point, I'd suggest that you change the tape and play the other side. I'm getting fairly close to the end of this side of the tape. And, there's probably a little bit more left on there, but better to do it now than do it in the middle of a further narrative.